So thanks for having me here. Always happy to share these results with people. So there's some interest here, and hopefully you'll have to talk about. So Coherent got together to measure this thing called SEVENS, coherent elastic neutrino nucleus scattering, just so everyone's on the same page. This is when a neutrino comes in and interacts with an entire atomic nucleus and sends that nucleus scattering sort of coherently. All the nucleons within the nucleus recoil in phase. And so this is a very low, low momentum transfer event. It is pretty difficult to see experimentally. The only experimental signature you see is the diagram here. You just give the nucleus a little bit of kick, and then it just sort of jiggles around all the surrounding nuclei, which can give off a few scintillation photons, which you can collect with a PMT or something. There's just a very tiny kinetic energy that you transfer to the nucleus. So for cesium iodide, which we'll be talking about today, the endpoint of the recoil energy distribution is this 2 neutrino energy squared divided by the nuclear mass. That works out to just about 15 keV for typical energies that we're dealing with. So hard to see, but to actually, we basically need a detector with both a low threshold and put in some experimental facility with a high neutrino flux to be able to see SEVENS. If you can't see SEVENS, however, we'll open you to a lot of physics. The cross section ends up being very high just because of this coherency innate to the actual interaction. So the cross section very roughly looks like this. So if you plug in what the prefactor on the proton number here is, the cross section basically just goes like the number of neutrons squared. The cross section is large. They're the blue curves that you see on this plot. There's something like 3 orders of magnitude higher than inverse beta decay in cesium iodide, which means if you want to do physics with SEVENS, you do need a low threshold detector, but you can get a measurement with a pretty small detector. Sort of kilogram scales are completely sufficient for doing these sorts of measurements. The first measurement was done by our collaboration back in 2017. With this cesium iodide detector that we're talking about. We've also seen SEVENS and argon, but we're not really going to be talking about those results today. So if you want to if you have a detector that can actually see SEVENS, it opens you up to a whole bunch of physics topics outside the standard model. These are just a few of the things that mostly other phenomenological theorists outside of Coherent have used our data to look at. But explicitly, we'll go through and talk a lot about dark matter and also a few new interactions that we can actually probe with SEVENS and SEVENS detectors. So dark matter, it's of course something very, very interesting. We know that dark matter accounts for something like 85% of the matter in their universe. And we have a bunch of different methods for actually testing the gravitational effect of dark matter. So this all started out with gravitational galactic rotational curves. And then you go into sort of more modern methods looking at the CMB spectrum, and then there's also gravitational lensing. So we keep improving our understanding of the gravitational and properties of dark matter, but we still don't know what the actual particles that make this dark matter up are. So that's interesting. There's new physics that we have a lot of evidence for, but we just haven't found it. We need a new place to look. And Coherent basically gives you a new place to look. We're sensitive to dark matter masses between about 1 and 220 MeV, which is parameter space, basically lower masses than conventional astroparticle methods. The dark matter that we're out here searching for is just totally within the freeze-out cosmology. So this is in the very early universe, everything is hot and compact. You have standard model particles colliding into each other, making dark matter particles, and the opposite annihilation process is also happening. And so you have sort of an equilibrium concentration of dark matter in the universe. And then the universe starts to cool and the production process no longer happens. And so you get this drop off in the concentration that you observe in the universe. And then eventually inflation starts happening and the dark matter concentration falls so low that 2 random dark matter particles in the universe can't really find each other to annihilate. And so both of those at that point, both of these two processes are quenched, and you again get a plateaued flux of dark matter. And it's the important thing to really get here is the higher dark matter cross section you have, the smaller the relic abundance you would expect in the modern universe. That just works out. If you have a higher cross section, you can deal with a lower concentration and still get a notable annihilation rate, which gives that an inverse relationship. And that's actually great. This is a simple cosmology and it's predictive. If you tell me what the dark matter mass is, we can just go ahead and say what the observed cross section ought to be, just based on this freeze out mechanism here. The one issue here, so for a long time, astroparticle experiments have basically focused on this diagram for dark matter scattering. So dark matter particle comes in, interacts with some standard model particle just by throwing out a Z boson. The problem is, if you actually look at the calculated out the cross section that you'd expect, you get this. It's proportional to 1/(1/4 Z mass to the fourth. So if you think about this a little bit, if you plug in a lower dark matter mass, that gives you a lower cross section from this formula. From the plot on the last page, that means you also have a higher relic dark matter abundance. At a certain point, you get dark matter mass so low that would start to basically predict much too much dark matter in the modern universe. It would close it off and it wouldn't sort of evolve into the modern universe that we see today. That cutoff is right around 2 GeV, which is more massive than the dark matter particles that we're really interested in now. The solution here is, well, don't have to assume that the dark matter interacts with standard model particles just from the weak force. You can also invent a new hidden sector force that basically some particle V that mediates between dark matter particles and standard model particles. And in this scenario, you modify what the cross section looks like. Now it's proportional to 1/(mv^4). And so you can just choose your dark matter chi and portal V particle masses to sort of be consistent that you can predict a modern cosmology at basically arbitrary mass scales. So this theory will still work perfectly fine down to sort of MeV mass scales and even below. If you look at interactions within this model, the simplest case gives you an interaction Lagrangian like this. So basically you just have you predict that this portal particle V kinematically mixes with a standard model photon. And so anytime that you have photons or electrons in a final state, you can basically spout off one of these portal particles, which can then decay into dark matter particles that you're actually interested in studying. There's four model parameters here. So the two masses for the dark matter and the portal particle. And then there's two couplings that this epsilon parameter is going to mediate between standard model and the mediator. It's that coupling constant. And then alpha D is the coupling constant between the dark matter and the mediator particles. To simplify this four-dimensional parameter space, we usually give the results in terms of this dimensionless parameter Y. So this parameter Y is just gonna be directly related to the dark matter scattering cross-section. So it's really easy to, if you show your results in terms of Y, to relate that to the various relic abundances that you'd expect. So beyond dark matter, we can also look for other things with the actual sevens, the neutrino interactions that we see in our detector. So just one example here, we're sensitive to non-standard interactions between neutrinos and quarks, mediated by some heavy mediator that is yet undiscovered. So if you, the Lagrangian for that looks something like this, and it's parameterized in terms of these epsilons. So alpha and beta can be E, mu, or tau for any of the leptons. And then Q, of course, can be either basically up or down quarks. And so this is just an arbitrary parameterization of what this potential new force could look like that couples together any lepton and quark. So there's sort of six different epsilon parameters. There are three that break flavor universality, the EE, mu, mu, and tau, tau components. If you wiggle those around, you can basically change the sevens cross-section for each flavor of neutrino. So you can make the electron scattering cross-section be significantly more than the muon scattering cross-section. And then there are also flavor changing modes where you can get a diagram where you take put an electron neutrino in and then get a muon neutrino out. And so the NSI scenarios here are actually really interesting in terms of neutrino oscillation data. So there's a lot of theoretical treatments out here, listed some here, where if you play around with these NSI parameters, you can basically induce degeneracies where that you basically confuse the with the given data that we have from experiments like NOVA and TDK, you can confuse which values you're estimating for each of these parameters. And so basically, if you just pick your favorite parameter in the neutrino mass mixing phenomenology, you can come up with some way, some combination of these NSI parameters to basically get the whole picture all wrong. So important to actually use scattering cross sections.
Sorry, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Is this Lagrangian SU2 invariant?
Yes.
Sorry, you have neutrino there. Why don't you have new left, L left?
It's not SU2 invariant. Unfortunately, this is a common parameterization for NSIs. If you pick a model, you're going to have also constraints from the charged lepton sector. And it's just the standard in neutrino physics to treat it this way. It's in a sense model independent. But you're right that for any reasonable theory, you would have to complete this.
Right. Okay. Yep. Sure. But
this is a very phenomenological way of doing this type of analysis.
Yes, but because neutrinos are embedded in SU2, you cannot just ignore the SU2. The world is SU2 invariant.
That's right.
Yeah. Right. It is meant to just be incredibly general and just sort of capture all possible things that can.
I don't understand how this is general if it breaks the symmetry of nature.
Right. I mean, in that case, it would only sort of introduce more freedom than you would actually have. So it's sort of a superset of the proto space that can actually exist. So in that sense, SU2 invariant.
Question, for example, let me ask you a concrete question. So what values of epsilon would you expect given if you were to try to make this SU2 invariant?
Right. I'm not sure. I would have to sit down and work that out.
Yeah. Okay. There are very strong constraints from the charged lepton sector, especially. However, there have been models in the literature that show you can get signatures from NSIs in the neutrino sector without violating constraints from the charged lepton sector. Those models exist. Mm-hmm. So one in principle should work with those full pictures to set constraints on these parameters. But I'm going to guess for experimental convenience, people just use this parameterization and forget about the charged lepton sector. But I agree with you, for a consistent description, we should include also the SU2 part here. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Thank you.
So that's exactly right with our strategy here. Certainly look at that more in the future. Now we're just giving these epsilon matrices just complete freedom to roam around. So that's sort of an aside. Getting back to actually coherent, how can we get access to this physics? So we came to Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee. It's got a spallation source. It spits out a lot of neutrons, but it also spits out a lot of neutrinos and hopefully a lot of dark matter particles also. So the beam is 1.4 megawatts and it's a proton beam hitting a marker target. The projectile energy there is right around 1 GeV. And the pulse width is pretty narrow, about 340 nanoseconds wide, operating at 60 Hertz. So if you plug in numbers there, that gives you something like a factor of 30,000 for reducing your backgrounds just from beam pulsing. That's actually pretty fundamental. It lets you put your detector on the surface and still get suitably low background rates to actually do physics, to actually see sevens or dark matter particles. This whole neutrino and dark matter program wasn't really expected when we were building the SNS. So it's sort of just an opportunistic physics program that you can just use to extend the fundamental physics reach at the SNS. So it's also not the sort of full story of the SNS. Within the next decade, we're expected to sort of improve the beam. So this is happening in two sort of stages here. So the first stage, in the next 10 years, we're going to implement the proton power upgrade. So that's basically going to double the power of the beam, which also doubles the power of your instantaneous flux, which helps with your signal to background ratio. And it's also going to make a second target station that you see here in gold feasible. The second stage here is to set up an actual second target station, which is actually interesting. It's going to give you basically two spallation beams right next to each other. They'll be operating with different spills from the accelerator. So you get three spills delivered to the first target station and then one spill to the second target station. And just repeating that indefinitely. So that gives you basically two simultaneous neutrino beams that you can use to sort of study the directional dependence of the various fluxes that you see. So if, for instance, we see a dark matter signature, since we expect there to be directional dependence of the dark matter flux, we can sort of test that with the two beams that we have side by side here, which will be really fantastic if there actually is dark matter here waiting to be discovered. Just helps build the case for actually seeing dark matter. This is sort of how we actually make dark matter at the SNS. So here in our target, we have just huge number of interactions between protons and mercury atoms. It's possible for very rare processes to actually spit out portal particles to hidden sector particles, such as these Chi dark matter particle candidates that we're hopeful to see. And this would create a flux of dark matter particles throughout the SNS, which can come and hit one of our dark matter detectors and come up with a nuclear recoil signature that we can see. So the only step that we really the SNS is already making these dark matter particles if they exist. All that we have to do is build a detector that is capable of seeing sevens and lower energy nuclear recoils to be able to detect these recoil signatures.
Can I just ask you, how is the production exactly? Because your neutrino production is coming from meson decay at rest, right? So you're producing pions, and I guess it's too low energy for kaons, but
yeah. So that's
imagine there's a difference in timing also, right? So it's Bremsstrahlung, so it's prompt, right?
Yeah. So most of it comes from meson decays in flight, so that is prompt. And of course, Brems are also prompt. So we can, do have a simulation where we can kind of predict the delay relative to the speed of light delay that you'd expect. And that's sort of on the scale of like a few nanoseconds, which is a lot smaller than the width of our beam. So we basically just assume that they're entirely prompt.
Oh, I see. How long does the pulse last?
It's 340 nanoseconds full width half max. So sort of on the scale of a microsecond. Thanks. Right, yeah. These are the three decay channels that we actually expect to be producing dark matter. So mostly you have pi zero decay going to a photon plus one of these portal particles. So that's going to dominate at low masses until basically it's no longer kinematically allowed. And then the blue here is eta decay, which is it's also a pseudoscalar meson, so same exact decays you'd expect. They just go to slightly higher dark matter masses. And then at the highest masses that you expect, you can still get production from Bremsstrahlung, where you just have a proton just breming off one of these portal particles when it gets near a nucleus. You see this increase right here, which is physical, that's right at the Rho resonance. So at that point, the mass of the quartile particle is just around the mass of the row, which just gives you increased rate right at those particular masses. There's also a neutrino flux at the SNS. So depending on whether you want to look at NSI or dark matter, this is either your signal or your background. And so this is, as we're already talking about, this is coming from pions decaying at rest. Same sort of thing. You have protons hitting a bunch of mercury atoms. One thing that can happen is you spit out charged pions. If you spit out a pi minus, that's going to just find a nearby nucleus and capture. So it's not going to give off any neutrinos. But if you make a pi plus, that's going to range out and decay with a half-life of 26 nanoseconds, making a neutrino and a positive muon. That positive muon is also going to range out and decay and give you two more neutrinos. So every pi plus that you create in the target is going to give you three neutrinos, but the timing distributions are different. So that's looking here at the bottom left. So first you have prompt neutrinos that come out from the initial pi zero decay. That's the red here. But then you also have delayed neutrinos that come from the muon decay. Those are basically delayed by a muon lifetime, which is about 2.2 microseconds. That's longer than our beam, so it effectively spreads everything out. And so the flux, the differential energy spectrum of the flux is also very well known. Most of the neutrino production that we have here is just decay at rest. So it's just really simple sort of undergraduate QFT to actually get those distributions out. The tails that you're seeing here are from decays in flight, which are sort of 1% of our total neutrino production at the SNS, which is pretty negligible for our experiments.
That bump was what? Muon capture or what?
Yes. Yeah. There's directionality of the flux just for dark matter production, essentially. So the neutrino flux is produced at rest, so everything is just isotropic. So if you plot the flux, they're just a bunch of concentric circles here for the contours that you see. This is also the largest beam-related background for dark matter searches. The dark matter produced is produced in flight, however, so that means it's all boosted. The flux is going to be very forward-directed, which is actually interesting. If you put a detector sort of in this area, that will increase your signal to background ratio, since most of your background is isotropic. The CSI data that we have to talk about today is sort of right at the orthogonal here. But in the future, when the STS is built, we're coordinating with the folks over at Oak Ridge to build a nice detector hall sort of forward in the beam so that we can exploit these differences to give us a boost in sensitivity. Getting out the better signal background ratios for your dark matter here. To actually get at this physics, so we as Coherent sort of joined up about 10 years ago to try and first measure sevens at the SNS. This we finally initially did with data in 2017, looking at results on the CSI detector. That followed up with results in 2019 on argon. And right now we are currently implementing additional detectors studying sevens on both germanium and sodium. Commissioning is starting sort of late this year, early next year on those two detectors. The problem with spallation source is it can be very messy. It's first and foremost, it's a neutron beam. Those are backgrounds for us. So we had to do a lot of initial preliminary background measurements. Just go around all the target hall, try and find a place that is sufficiently quiet so that we can do neutrino and dark matter detection experiments. We ended up finding a basement hallway where we can now know that the neutron flux is sufficiently quiet. We can implement a few detectors there and actually see sevens or dark matter recoils. We also have a few detectors just to monitor the neutron background and sort of map out the flux there so that we can also understand more of our backgrounds. Before going into things, I just want to give a few advantages of these low recoil detectors. So this is sort of a new method for going about dark matter at accelerators, and it has quite a few advantages. So the first is just coherency. We're dealing with very low Q-squared, so basically the de Broglie wavelength is large compared to the nuclear radius, which means this whole nucleus scatters sort of coherently, which gives you this nice coherency factor in the cross-section. This is a trick that astroparticle experiments have been using for decades, and that's also really helped their sensitivity. But until coherent, accelerator experiments basically haven't been able to do that. Now with Sevens detectors, we can get the same, we can exploit the same large cross-section. And yeah, this coherency gives you the C squared factor, which is pretty huge for CSI. Basically these three detectors are the main players right now for most sensitive direct detection limits on these dark matter models. Coherent has similar sensitivity to the other two, but we're about four orders of magnitude less massive, which really just shows how if you invest in a very sensitive but small mass detectors, small mass detector, you can really have, there's a lot of physics potential to actually reap there. So the other is just reducing our model dependence. With the freeze-out scenario, as a function of the dark matter mass, we can calculate what the scattering cross-section should be for dark matter, which is exactly what you're seeing with the black curves here. The only difference is there is some freedom in what the dark matter particle actually looks like. What is the mass term? Is it a scalar or a fermion? And also, if it is a fermion, is it Majorana fermion or pseudo-Dirac fermion? Depending on which all those questions the dark matter particle actually is, you would end up drawing different curves on this plot for the actual cross-section. And unfortunately, there's a lot of variability here. If you just look at astroparticle experiments, these different targets for the relic abundances are about 20 orders of magnitude off from each other. If, however, you go to accelerators, the differences between each of these scenarios basically shrinks down to about of a factor of 20 versus 10 to the 20. So that means that basically all of the relic lines are accessible with experiment, basically completely independent of what the mass term actually looks like. And so in this sense, coherent basically gets the best of both worlds. We're more or less independent of the dark matter nature, like all the accelerator methods, but we do also have this large cross-section like various astroparticle methods. So we sort of sit right in between and get the best out of each strategy that way. Just one more quick note here. We also have great ways to constrain our systematic uncertainties. Just looking at, this is the timing of the neutrino flux at the SNS. There's interesting time structure here. The dark matter particles we would expect to be prompt, basically coincident with this red histogram here, all the muon neutrino flux. But we also have flux coming from the decay of muons. So that gives you the blue curve here. We have this background control region where we expect no signal dark matter events, but we do expect lots of background sevens events. So we can look at what sevens we see in that background control region and use that to understand things like our light yield and our quenching and our neutrino flux, and apply those as sort of in situ measurements to of our uncertainties, and apply those to our background in the reach of interest for the dark matter, and really nail down what our, get an accurate prescription for what the background rate should be there. And then you just have to look for, do you see some dark matter access over that constrained background? This is great. It basically means that systematics, our analyses are never systematic limited. We're always beating against just statistical errors, because more exposure we have, the better we can constrain our systematics from this background control region. So we never really reach any sort of quenching in sensitivity from those effects. So with that, we can finally start talking about data. So this is our CSI detector. So this is just a very small scintillating crystal of CSI doped with sodium, built at the University of Chicago. There's just a single PMT connected here to read out all the light produced in the crystal. You see it's getting put down in here into a shielding. The shielding design is composite. There's both high Z and low Z stuff. to filter out gamma background and neutron background respectively. So you can see all the different materials that go into this shielding there. This was the detector that made the first observation of sevens. So this is how what we saw there. This is a measurement to 6.7 sigma that sevens actually exists, that the number of counts is not zero. And we see about 134 events, which is totally consistent with the expected 173, given all the errors that we expected. The data was released, and the FINO community has done a lot of studies looking at various BSM scenarios with this data, and actually come up with some pretty strong constraints in each one of these fields. So the real problem with this detector that we've had to deal with is this thing called afterglow.
Sorry, can I ask you? Can I ask you a question? So in the previous slide, you say there's this observation of. So what's the how does the signal look like? Why is it different than background?
So a lot of these do induce sort of spectral shifts, things like the neutrino magnetic moment. That wouldn't just pile up more sevens. That would basically give you a huge influx of events at sort of low recoil energies.
No. I'm not talking about like neutrino magnetic moment. I'm talking about like actual backgrounds. So your seven signal is just say a 15 keV energy deposition that you measure in your scintillator, right?
That's right. It basically comes down to spectral and timing information. So we do a 2D fit in those two variables. Your background is going to have a different energy distribution. And really key is the timing, since the timing of those backgrounds is going to be flat. But the signal is basically going to follow the shape of the neutrino flux. It definitely has a lot of shape. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Do you have any neutron capture inside of the detector or no? Is it just neutron elastic?
Neutron capture is way higher energy. That's few MeV. Okay. We're dealing with keV, but we definitely have neutron scatters. That for our argon measurement, that was actually very important. We saw actually more neutron scatters than sevens. But in this detector, the sevens to neutron scatter fraction is something like a factor of 20. So it's just a pretty small background that we have. We have some data to constrain what the normalization is, but we can live with pretty large systematics on what that flux is, what that neutron normalization is.
A bit unrelated maybe, but if you have neutron capture, would you be able to see it with some confidence?
Not in this detector.
Or is it too high energy?
Yeah, you get beyond the dynamic range of your photodetectors, and it just looks like you just see that the PMT is saturated.
Because in principle, you could constrain the number of neutrons in that way, right? And then,
that's true. To get about this, I actually might as well talk about this since I decided to not put the slides in. But before we put in the actual sevens detector, we had just a liquid scintillator detector that we put in there with a threshold of hundreds of keV, not something that you can really see sevens with. And basically from that, it's scintillator, it's basically just carbon and hydrogen. So it's got a large neutron background. And basically use that to see how many neutron scatters we actually see, get the energy distribution, and tune our simulation to that. That was in the exact same shielding that we put our sevens detector. And so we just swapped the detectors in and out. And so that gave us sort of a data-driven estimate of what our backgrounds are going to be.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, I don't even know if it would capture in your target material, but anyway, thanks.
Yeah, you might. The principle there is you get just coherent scatters, elastic scatters from the neutrons. That is a background that we do have to deal with. You'll see that in plots later on. The real issue that we have to deal with in this detector is afterglow. So this is the timing of scintillation photons coming out of the crystal for CSI with two different dopants. And this, if you look at the x-axis here, we continue to see scintillation in the activity in a crystal up to after like a microsecond after a large physics event comes and deposits a lot of energy. This is our reason for choosing sodium as our dopant, even though it's sort of less common for most CSI measurements. That significantly reduces this rate of afterglow and also biases it to times closer to the actual interaction time. So basically, the dead time is about 100 microseconds after a prompt physics thing like a cosmic ray going through the detector happens, versus something like almost a second for other dopants. And this is actually, this is good. This allows us to be able to see sort of few KeV nuclear recoils over the scintillation rate. And so moving to the sodium doped CSI is actually, it will allow us to actually see sevens of dark matter scatters.
Sorry, can I ask you a quick question? Maybe you said that I forgot. At what depth underground is your detector, given that you mentioned the cosmic rays?
Yeah, it's about an eight meter water equivalent overburden. So yes, we still do see cosmic rays, but remember the beam is pulsed. So that really drastically reduces the background rate that you see. It's 1,000 or more. That lets us do physics that you could otherwise only do underground. So another issue that you have to do here, have to figure out before you can actually go see sevens is calibrate how much scintillation you expect. So if you just imagine giving a little kick to a cesium or an iodine nucleus within our crystal, it's going to lose energy mostly just by thermally kicking around other nuclei in its vicinity. Only a fraction of the actual energy loss goes into ionization energy. So the two variables that you have there are the initial nuclear recoil energy and the total ionization energy that you get out. You need some curve to basically map between these two variables, which isn't known a priori. So you have to just take a few measurements, just ancillary measurements to nail that down. And we, with our CSI and sodium dopant, we actually have five measurements of these crystals. It's sort of throughout the region of interest for sevens and dark matter recoils. We have these ancillary measurements here that we have just some empirical model for what EEE is as a function of E and R. And then we just take this central value fit plus error band and propagate that to analysis, which can then give you some estimate for what our efficiency is and what sort of the error on that efficiency is. And the last step here is really calibrating our detector. So that's relatively straightforward. You take a few radioactive sources that we have two that give about 60 keV of ionization energy. We place them by the detector and we see how much light we actually read out. So the blue here is a gamma decay from americium. And then you also have the black data up here, which gives you neutron capture on iodine. And also a little bit of a nuclear recoil. Looking at the light output, we see something like 13 photons read out per keV of ionization energy that you put in. And you can also show that the detector is nice and uniform, sort of everywhere within about 3%. We also consistently monitor what the photoelectron charge is for a single photon measured in the PMT. Just throughout data detecting through data collection, basically just using these accidental afterglow peaks that we were talking about earlier. Now we can go ahead and just analyze our data. We have just a single PMT to look at all the events that we see related to the beam. So all that we have to do in reconstruction is analyze this single waveform. So there's a few different regions that are interesting here. So there are two regions of interest. We call them C and AC for coincident and anti-coincident. So the C region is immediately preceding the beam, which is the green line that you have here. So anything beam related is going to show up in your coincident region of interest. The anti-coincident region of interest comes up right before that. So you know that there isn't anything beam related in that region. So you can use that to estimate all of your steady state backgrounds in situ, which is great because then you can get sort of an unbiased measurement of what that is without any systematic uncertainty. You don't have to know exactly what your neutron spall rate and efficiency for those events actually looks like. You can just measure it in situ without having to rely on any sort of simulation. The ROI itself is 15 microseconds long, and we have an integration window of 3 microseconds the first time that we see an actual PE pulse. So you see some nuclear recoil is here in the quiescent region, possibly beam related. And so you just find the first photoelectron that goes above your threshold and just integrate all the peaks that follow in the 3 microsecond window after that. And that gives you your estimate for what the actual energy is. With that, we can calculate what our efficiency is. So this is expected as a function of recoil energy for dark matter events. So we get about 9 keV threshold where our efficiency is about 50%. And if you look at over the full range here, we expect something like a 21% efficiency at our dark matter or mass where we have peak sensitivity around 25 MeV. And it's also worth mentioning here that this efficiency curve is actually really well known. We have basically calibration data, which spits out a few low energy sort of few keV events, just the same sort of events that we're trying to study with sevens and dark matter, and basically use that to figure out that data to figure out what our efficiency curve actually looks like. And so now we can go ahead and predict excess events in our sample. So this is excess events over steady state background, both the sevens events in orange and dark matter events in the light blue here. So if there actually is dark matter in our beam, it would show up at prompt times, sort of entirely coincident with the arrival of the beam. And there's also some energy differences where the dark matter distribution extends to higher number of photoelectrons. So that's interesting. There's differences in both recoil time and energy. So the thinking here is just do a 2D fit for the normalization of each of these two populations, fit out how many sevens events you actually expect your data actually suggests are in your sample, and do this exact same thing with the dark matter events simultaneously. And also the recoil distribution here, there's differences, but there's also a lot of overlap between the two. So to really get a lot of your sensitivity to the dark matter regions, you have to do this sort of 2D fit. And again, you can use these sort of delayed seven events that you expect here to amend how many prompt sevens events you expect here under your dark matter to just give you an in situ estimate for what that background actually is. So now we can do that dark matter. We can look at what our data looks like. This is exactly it. So this is subtracting off steady state background here. So you see purple here is neutron events. And then the orange here is standard model sevens. And then the blue is what we think, what kind of dark matter could exist in the beam. The data that we see is actually very consistent with just the standard model backgrounds. So no excess of dark matter signal is seen. In the dark matter region of interest here, where all the dark matter piles up with the beam, there's actually sort of a small deficit, sort of all consistent within statistical errors, but there are fewer data events than we actually expect for the standard model background that says that we won't actually see dark matter this time around. It must be at lower parameters, harder to see, but we can put sort of constraint on what the parameter space actually looks like. And so that is what we'll go ahead and do. We can also look at the
what's going on with that first bin there?
It's just about one sigma up. So keep in mind that there is sort of steady state background below this that's also there, that's subtracted off.
Oh, it's subtracted. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Thanks.
So how large is the steady state background that you're subtracting, which is not shown here, yes?
Yeah, that's right. It's something like 5 times the number of sevens.
I see.
And
what's the uncertainty on the sevens event rate calculation?
Yeah. So the I mean, that's the error on this number here. It basically boils down to what the neutrino flux is. So sevens itself is very cleanly predicted in the standard model. It's easy to calculate what the cross-section is. There's something like a 3 or 4% uncertainty on the actual cross-section, basically just from form factor expression. We don't know quite to how far neutrons are on average from the sort of center of the nucleus. So that's sort of the intrinsic uncertainty in the standard model for what the cross-section actually is. But then there are detector response uncertainties that balloon the total error budget up to about 12%.
But isn't there a large uncertainty just on the beam?
Yeah. That there's a 10% uncertainty on the flux, which is the bulk of what goes in here. There's also things like the light yield and quenching, which
I see. But why the uncertainty on the beam is so small? This is all meson decays, right? But the meson multiplicity in the target, I guess, it's not very well known, right? The meson production rate in the target. That probably has like order one like errors, I guess. Like you don't know how many ETAs are produced, right? Exactly. Right.
So that's a good point. And we're planning on looking at this with real data. But right now we're just, this 10% number basically comes from a bunch of different physics lists in JAN4, plug the simulation code through with each of those physics lists, see the spread and how many mesons that we get out, and then we get the 10% that way. It would be very fantastic if we had real data to actually compare to. And we actually just put out a paper on the archive recently that sort of does that, looks at data coming out of HARP, which explicitly looked at like pion yields coming out of like proton heavy element collisions, which is actually an interesting study, which says 10% is basically the right number for your flux uncertainty to have here. But really what we do want to have is some sort of estimate for what the neutrino flux is.
Exactly.
So that is, we have an idea to look at that with basically heavy water. So deuterium and oxygen atoms. It turns out that the neutrino cross-section is known theoretically to about 3% on deuterium. So if you just measure the event rate, you can get flux uncertainty of about 3%, just looking at, just dividing those two out. So that's sort of our, we just actually got a module of that detector funded. So we'll soon sort of have data to sort of get a better uncertainty of what that flux is.
I see. But could it be that then, since the meson multiplicity uncertainty is apparently not included in this number, could it be that the uncertainty is larger and that actually you do not have enough sensitivity to claim sevens discovery? Can that be a possibility?
So to actually claim discovery, no, right? The discovery of sevens, your null hypothesis is no sevens at all. And so at that point, it doesn't matter what the multiplicity in the target is, you still get no sevens events. So that actually factors out. It does matter if you're actually trying to measure what the sevens cross-section is and sort of propagate that to like interesting physics. The 10% error on the flux is sort of meant to encapsulate the errors on the pion multiplicity that we expect in the target, which this new study that we have out on the archive comparing to data with HARP does say that 10% is roughly right. But this isn't a thing in the future, especially when we have more larger statistics measurements and very precise. This is a thing that we will definitely have to think about.
I understand the point, but yeah, I'm worried that, for instance, you say you have events over the expected backgrounds, but I guess that the expected backgrounds are also not extremely, especially because they are 5 times larger than your signal. I guess that they also have uncertainties. So I could imagine a nightmare scenario where actually the events that you're seeing, it's misunderstood backgrounds that you're somehow incorrectly subtracting. Right. And your sevens cross section also has a larger uncertainty. So actually,
steady state is constrained.
That's right.
And for them, the only thing that really matters is the number of pions produced.
Yes.
And that's pulsed. So in principle, you would be able to tell if there is a signal that is on time or not. And I'm guessing that your sevens is on time.
Right? That's right.
No, but I mean, they are subtracting their flat background, which is irreducible, right? Which is a factor of 5 times larger than the scene.
But it's constrained.
We know exactly what it is. Basically, this plot, we use this AEC region to explicitly construct what the background is. And we also have ways of testing this. Like we look at very high energy events, compare the where we don't expect any sevens, compare the steady state backgrounds in the AC and C region of interest here, and see explicitly that they are the same, that there aren't any sort of pathologies with transferring between these two that introduces something that could look sevens-like.
Okay. Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. But yeah, that, thanks. That is a good question. So, that's the timing distribution. We're also fitting in recoil energy. So this is projected onto that other dimension. So the two plots that you're seeing here are the region of interest for the dark matter on the left, and then just everything that is delayed, everything after that region of interest. And so basically you can use sort of this delayed window to sort of understand everything about your uncertainties on your background. And you see that the sevens agrees pretty well with your data here. And then you apply these uncertainties under over to your left and look for any sort of significant excess. Unfortunately, no significant excess is seen yet. So we have to keep looking. But from doing these sorts of tricks, we can just immediately do a 2D fit to figure out how many dark matter events there are. And if you do that, it works out to something like less than 15 to 20. So this is the delta chi-square curve that you get for how many dark matter events are actually in our sample for three different masses. This curve slightly depends on what the dark matter mass looks like. The dashed line that you see here is sort of interesting. Since we're right near a physical boundary, the number of dark matter events can't be less than zero. We do expect some non-Gaussian statistics. So then we just have to explicitly simulate what the delta chi-square distribution should look like. So we do that with Feldman-Cousins, and that gives you this dotted line up here. That's sort of the critical value that you would expect to be able to claim 90% significance for a result. So just look at where these colored curves cross this dashed line. And that gives you your constraint that you would actually, that our data actually implies. And of course, doing that for all the masses that we're looking at, we can give our 90% confidence interval here. So this is the contour that we draw. So we have the tightest constraint that yet exists for masses between 11 and 165 MeV. Actually, an interesting thing here is if you compare the actual data measurement here and our sensitivity, our data is a bit stronger than our sensitivity just because there was that deficit of events relative to the background in the dark matter region of interest, but all consistent with some statistical errors. And really interesting, we're the first of these lines to sort of probe beyond this, beyond the relic abundance, this black line here, over a pretty small range of masses, but still that sort of signifies a pretty significant boost in our sensitivity compared to other experiments right here. And all achieved with this small sort of 14 kilogram detector that someone can physically pick up on their own. So just building bigger in the future promises us to a bright future for really nailing down this parameter space.
Any of the other curves drawn by experimentalists, or is yours the only one?
Yes, the mini boon. And CCM both here are drawn by the experimentalists. But most of these are, theory groups look at the data and sort of draw their curves themselves.
Thanks.
One thing to look at here, we have two coupling parameters within this dark matter model, but we only have one y-axis to look at the coupling. So there is some additional freedom here. In the last plot, we assume that the alpha D parameter is exactly equal to 0.5, which gives this solid purple contour. If you say that alpha D is smaller, the contour gets progressively better. So that sense, if you alpha D equals 0.5 is sort of the one of the most conservative assumptions that you can make. If you start to make that larger, you start to get large perturbative effects. The cross-sections only calculate at tree value, so you start to not really expect it to be true. But we do have stronger constraints for anything less than that. So we can sort of say that we're closing up the parameter space where we can eliminate this relic abundance at alpha d sort of at the most conservative values. You can pivot that to try and make a model dependent contour for both coherent and these other experiments by basically asking, just instead of thinking that, oh, our current contours can change based on what alpha d we assume, we can instead ask at a particular mass what value of alpha d would we need to make our contour directly match up with the relic abundance. And that's what you're looking at here. So at our most sensitive, we can eliminate alpha d to less than about 0.64 in the scalar dark matter case. If you do look at these fermionic cases and for Majorana or pseudo-direct dark matter, limits are worse. You expect the cross-section to be a factor of about 2 or 20 lower. But we can still make some statement on how well we can constrain those dark matter models. And in the future, we'll be able to improve on these constraints significantly. Speaking of which, there are two detectors here that we actually have pretty optimistic detection chances for with dark matter. The first that we have here is a coherent germanium detector, which is actually getting implemented this year. So this is a germanium PPC detector. It's got a very low threshold, which actually is good for looking at dark matter with low masses. This is fully funded, starting commissioning basically now. In the future, we have a next generation argon detector. So this is going to be a ton scale, 610 kilogram fiducial volume of just argon scintillator. And this is also, we have in the future preliminary plans for something like a 10 ton argon detector that we can place in the second target station. And also we have this actually sort of new idea. We have the next generation CSI detector, which we're also going to put at sort of cryogenic temperatures. The plot that you're looking at here is both the light yield and the afterglow rate in CSI as a function of energy, as a function of the temperature that you keep the crystal at. So if you go to 40 Kelvin, you can get both very high light yields for CSI and very low afterglow rates, this red curve down here, which basically means you can get an incredibly quiet low threshold detector with high Z. So you can get actually a very favorable sensitivity even with just a 10 kilogram detector. If we go through and actually look at physics sensitivities for each of these, this is essentially what you get. The purple is current CSI data. Orange here is germanium detector, which we're implementing now. It'll extend our sensitivity down to lower masses very soon. And then sort of in the few year time scales, we can look at the solid green and purple, which are the argon and cryogenic CSI detectors respectively. And those can start looking at the Majorana fermion target line. And then in the next decade, when we have the second target station up and running and we can put sort of 10 ton scale detectors there, we can start getting really ambitious and actually look at parameter space throughout sort of all the sort of types of dark matter particles that we can actually expect here. So we can test the scalar, Majorana, and pseudo-direct thermal relics here. Right. So, this is also just comparing to other sensitivities that are out there. There's also the coherent Captain Mills detector, which is sort of our other detector out there that has sort of the best sensitivity. Those are now the red lines that we have here. They're still sort of figuring out their backgrounds and thresholds that they can set. And so these different dotted lines are different assumptions that they can eventually get down to. But there's sort of, in the best case scenario, at about the same sensitivity that coherent can get at the first target station, sort of within the next sort of 5 years or so. And coherent at the second target station can, of course, extend beyond that. with that, since we haven't found dark matter yet, we can look at a little bit of physics with sevens. So this is how well we can actually measure the sevens cross-section. So the plot here, the gray band is the actual theoretically predicted standard model cross-section for sevens with a small uncertainty. And then the blue curves are our delta chi-square curves. So everything is consistent with the standard model. And we can also plot the cross-section as a function of neutron number. And you see for the two measurements that exist on cesium iodide and argon from coherent, we're both consistent with this sort of n squared dependence that the standard model expects. And then interestingly, we can also split up the sevens spectra by flux component. So the different colors that you're seeing here are sevens from different flavors of neutrinos. Brown is the nu mu flux, orange the nu mu bar, and gold the nu e. So these all have different, both different energy distributions and different timing distributions. And we can basically use this timing differences here to break apart the cross-section for muon-type neutrinos and electron-type neutrinos separately. And that's actually a great way to test flavor universality. A lot of BSM scenarios would predict different sevens cross-sections for each of these, for each flavor separately. And so we try to get apart from that by, we try to pick up on that physics by measuring the cross-section for both muon type and electron type neutrinos separately. So we now introduce these two flavored cross-sections, which are now allowed to be completely unconstrained in whatever we allow any values for these cross-sections are. And we can just go ahead and actually measure what we think those two independent flavored cross-sections actually are. This is the parameter space that we're now looking at. So this is one, two, and three sigma contours that you're looking at compared to the actual standard model cross-section that you'd expect, where these are roughly the same cross-sections for both electron and muon neutrinos. And we see that the data is, errors are still kind of large, but we are still consistent with the standard model here.
Is mu, nu mu, and nu mu bar, or just nu mu?
Yeah, that's right.
Both, okay.
Yeah. In the future, you can try and pick apart all three, but you do need quite a big data sample to do that. Mm. Yeah. And yeah, so this is actually a great way to go apart picking out the NSI parameter space, because these different epsilons will change different flavored cross-sections in different ways. And so this is what new data actually looks like. So previous results come from CHARM. So quite big contours here, and CSI clearly eats away a lot of the parameter space that was previously allowed. And we can also look at different slices of this sort of generic epsilon parameter space that we have. So this is comparing the basically the coupling to the EE component and the mu mu component. And so this is actually a very interesting combination of parameters to look like, to look at. This is in the context of neutrino oscillations, particularly solar oscillations. So the two bands of gray that you see here are basically two swaths of parameter space that are consistent with the large mixing angle solar solution and the LMA dark model. So these two are different in the mixing angle theta 1-2, basically depending on which one of these models you assume, you flip theta 1-2 across the octant. So theta 1-2 goes to pi over 2 minus theta 1-2. But if we actually look at the parameter space allowed by coherent, we're pretty broadly consistent with this LMA solution, but quite strongly disfavor this LMA dark solution. And so already this coherent data is starting to disambiguate the sort of allowed some beyond the standard model physics that actually messes with neutrino oscillation data. Yes, and so yeah, that is it for our sort of summary of recent data coming out of coherent. So thanks for dropping by and listening. So we have now made the first search for dark matter particles at the SNS. And we have just this new method for actually seeing nuclear recoils, which gives you large cross-section. There's a lot of interesting timing information to constrain all of your backgrounds and so forth. That allows us to put a very competitive measurement on the summary plot for a lot of parameter space. And we can also do things like probe neutrino quark NSI with the same data set, which is already helping to understand neutrino oscillation data. And this is by no means it. In the future, we'll have more SEVENS experiments, more SEVENS data. And that's going to sort of give another sort of huge jump and be able to test sort of parameter space consistent with cosmology over basically any type of dark matter that is consistent with cosmological observations. So yeah, thanks. And I guess we have some time for questions.
So thank you very much, Daniel. I can thank Daniel virtually. Are there any more questions? I do have to run. I just wanted to say it is a bit unfortunate that people in the neutrino community use NSIs very often. I guess it gives you some constraint on generic type of neutrino new interactions. But yes, I mean, Mina is not here anymore, but it is a generic parameterization, but it is unfortunate that it doesn't have very good theoretical grounding. But yes, very right. Interesting results. So thank you very much. I have to go now, but yeah.
Yep, sure. There were a few other hands that I think went down. Anyone else with a question? I think.
Yeah, can I ask you something? So these 500 events that you see in the background, they are you guys think that it's coming mostly from this afterglow thingy?
Yeah, so there is a component from afterglow. Mostly though, it's almost certainly just due to cosmic rays. Like cosmic rays are constantly spalling off neutrons, which then go interact in your detector and give us a little recoil that looks kind of like a SEVENS. So that we think is the main culprit. Fortunately, we don't really have to actually rely on simulation. We just sort of measure this out of time, ANSI coincident region to figure that out and not have to simulate.
I see. But within your signal region was like what, 40 microseconds or something, or 50 microseconds?
So for SEVENS here, we got the 6 microsecond long or basically five. Pulse where we see stuff.
Or 6 microseconds. Within those 6 microseconds, you're seeing 200 events and 500 background, which are mostly cosmics. That's the point, right?
Right.
I see. So within the 600 microsecond window, the statistics for the background is pretty large, so that the statistics is large. So the statistical error, it's smaller.
Right.
I see.
Yeah, this is just a problem with living near the surface. Unfortunately, they don't have spallation neutron sources underground because that would be way too expensive. But so we just have to live with some cosmic background here.
And why don't you put an active veto around the, well, I guess it's more expensive. Why don't you just like surround your detector with an active veto?
We do have a cosmic veto. To some degree see that. Unfortunately, there isn't really enough space to make a big veto that can sort of have like 100% efficiency for detecting these neutrons. So most of the neutrons that we did a study trying to correlate neutrons that we see in the detectors with neutrons in the shielding, we couldn't see much. So most of them just pass through the small veto.
Are you guys sure that it's cosmics and it's not, for instance, radioactivity from the environment of just your lab?
It could be. If it was radioactivity, we would expect sort of some differences between whether the beam is on or beam is off. We don't see that. It could be that there is radioactivity with very large lifetimes, which is dominating. We aren't 100% sure that that is not it.
I see.
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Yep. Sorry, any other questions out there?
So I'll just keep asking stuff. For your future projections, then your afterglow definitely goes down at smaller temperatures if you go to cryogenic temperatures. but the backgrounds you're saying are coming probably mostly just from ambient radiation, not from afterglow.
Yes, with the analysis strategy that we have right now, it turns out that afterglow events are all at very low energies. So basically, if we tackle that afterglow background, we can push the threshold. We'll still get some cosmic background there, but it won't be astronomically huge and totally dwarf out any signal. So the smallness of this red afterglow curve here basically says that now we can start looking at very low thresholds, something like sub KeV nuclear recoil energy.
I see. And just to understand, so the afterglow backgrounds is just because the beam itself, it's exciting something, and then that just takes makes a flat decay or something like that?
Yeah, it's not really the beam related. It can be something simple like a cosmic ray muon goes through, and just anything with like prompt energy deposit over like an MeV or so, the crystal will continue scintillating according to this red curve up to sort of 10,000 microseconds that you see here. So sort of a decent fraction of a second. And so that basically it will just continue spitting out just random photon peaks that aren't associated with the stuff in your beam. And so those can sort of pile up and be coincident on each other and sort of mimic an event. And that's why they're so prevalent at low thresholds. The combinatorics works out that it's a lot easier to see like a 2 or 3 photon thing from this random coincident of afterglow than something like a 10 photon thing.
I see. Okay, yeah, I understand. So it's just because you're trying to push down the thresholds and then at low thresholds, like a cosmic ray hitting directly your detector, it will be a large energy deposition that will fall in a different energy mean in your beaming. So that's not what you're going after.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, it will help. The lower threshold will help you look at different masses of dark matter. Basically the spectrum that you get depends on what the dark matter mass looks like. Lower masses give you basically softer distributions. So the lower threshold will actually be particularly helpful at those lower masses.
Yeah, may I ask for the dark matter projections, how do you compare with the other detectors that is?
Other experiments out there?
Yeah, like the one in Slack.
LDMX, you mean? They proposed
Right.
Yeah. So LDMX, the curve sort of cuts out down around here. We do have some explicit plots looking at the differences there, but we're sort of looking at CCM here because it's sort of also a direct detection experiment. So there's sort of a qualitative difference between direct detection experiments like Coherent and these sort of missing energy or missing momentum experiments like LDMX. So if we do actually see dark matter, we're going to want to directly see the evidence of the scatters. So these are necessarily, these are experiments that we'll have to think about in the case of a positive signature. It just so happens that CCM, the red lines that you see here are sort of the most optimistic projections that we see out there of direct detection experiments. So that's why that's chosen.
And the energy thresholds that you're going after, it's like KeV, I guess?
Right, yeah, it's 9 KeV nuclear recoil energy is about the threshold here.
For your future thingies?
Yeah, so all depends on, which is my list, yeah, so... So germanium it deals with ionization instead of scintillation. So that gives you basically a very low threshold, something like a KeV NR. These argon detectors, their benefit is basically they're just big and easy to build. And we have a lot of experience making these sort of detectors, but they don't have the best thresholds, something like 20 KeV or so. And then this cryogenic scintillation detectors, they can also get sort of KeV scale.
Interesting. There's this, maybe you know about this, but there's this dark matter experiment, it's called CREST 3, that also has KV energy thresholds, and they have, I think it overrides cryogenic temperatures, like what you're proposing for the future. The target is calcium tungstate though. And they see a large amount, number of backgrounds, and they have no idea where they are coming from. I wonder if you guys will be able to say something about that, even though the target is different, but maybe yeah. It's something environmental, in which case you may see something similar.
Yeah, so these are good test stand measurements to actually go out and do. The collaborator looking at this cryogenic idea sort of has a grant to look at, build an actual prototype and see sort of what the backgrounds at the surface are. So if the background really is dominated by cosmics, he'll basically see sort of approximately the right spectrum there. So hopefully that will keep us from any huge surprises. The only problem would be is if there is actually a huge radioactive component if we go at the SNS. It doesn't seem like there is at sort of 10 keV nuclear recoil thresholds, but potentially at lower thresholds, you could start to see that. So that is a potential problem. But yes, that is definitely interesting to understand. Luckily with the pulsing of the beam, we have a lot of tools for once we actually have the detector, we can figure out what the backgrounds are. But yeah, it is, like you say, sort of hard to predict before you actually just have the detector.
Yeah, that's true. There's an 8 keV copper line or something in the, it spits out a gamma or something, it's right there. Okay,
yeah.
It's really, really cool stuff.
Right, okay, any other questions out there?
Let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Yes.
Thanks a lot, it was a great talk.
For having coming here.
Thank you.
Yeah.